This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster. Hey, welcome back to Faster. This is your host, John Thornham. I just finished recording an awesome podcast with Dr. Chris Winter. He was on the show a few years back, and there's been a lot of stuff come out about sleep recently, and we decided to have him back on the show. And we get into a number of different topics in this episode. We talk about the concept of being a night owl versus somebody who wakes up early in the morning. We talk about training times. What's the optimal time to train? Things are around eating. Is intermittent fasting good? And if you eat, does that help with your sleep at different windows? Same thing from sugar. What does sugar do to sleep and how does that impact your sleep? We talk about kids. I recently had a kid and that definitely impacts sleep. And so if you're getting less sleep than needed, what are the best things to do around training? We talk about coffee, the use of coffee and sleep pressure and how ATP impacts your sleep and a number of other things. It's a great show. He's always a great guest to have on. He's very funny, has a lot of experience, works with a ton of pro athletes and a number of other things. If you want to learn how to get faster by optimizing your sleep, check out this episode and we'll see you soon. Ride safe. When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show. Dr. Winter, welcome back to Faster.
Thank you very much for having me, John. It's great to be back.
Yeah, great to have you back. So we had you on a few years back talking about sleep. You are the sleep expert, and I've been reading a bunch of things recently. I read a couple of books actually about dreaming, which I found very fascinating, and reading a lot of stuff about longevity, reading a lot of things too about the concepts of scarcity and abundance, especially when it comes to working and athletes. And I know that a lot of athletes are overworked and overtrained in a lot of situations, and sleep sometimes falls to the wayside. So just want to talk about that a little bit. I know recently there's been something that I've been looking at, and I was actually studying the use of testosterone I had somebody that was talking a lot about the use of testosterone and how it's so beneficial for somebody if you up your testosterone levels through some of these clinics. And I was trying to understand why somebody would feel so great, but there's so many negative side effects with it. And it led me down this rabbit hole of scarcity versus abundance. So in the moment when somebody is taking the testosterone, they have an abundance of testosterone, but that doesn't help them from a long-term perspective. If you don't take testosterone, then what that does is you're not impacting yourself in the short term, and it can help you potentially in the long run from a longevity perspective. So can you talk a little bit about that from a sleep perspective? Because I know that there's a lot of people out there that feel like, oh, I can sleep when I'm dead, or I'll skip this because I have a workout, or it's more important for me to get my workout in as opposed to sleeping.
Yeah, I mean, everything that our bodies do, and you can have a similar conversation about melatonin, you can have a similar conversation about human growth hormone, testosterone, any sort of hormone that's being created by the pituitary. All of these things are released on a schedule. I tell people all the time, your body's not doing anything accidentally, and we know that. I mean, if you look at a heartbeat, I mean, we call it circadian rhythm. We call it a heartbeat has a rhythm to it that you can predict. If you sit there and sort of tap out your heartbeat and you stop listening to it, you can continue the rhythm. You can kind of pick it up if things are working positively. A woman cycles on a 30-day rhythm. So our bodies are sort of built on these sort of schedules, and hormone release is a great example of that. When we think about circadian rhythm, we often think about sleep because we can see that. I didn't feel or see my testosterone release last night during sleep, but I assume it happened. And so, when you look at sleep and performance, you're hitting on an idea that sacrificing sleep is not just sacrificing the hours you spend in bed. It's sacrificing the processes that go along with that sleep at that time. And you know, the one we think about most when it comes to sleep is probably growth hormone secretion that's typically tied most strongly to deep sleep. When we engage in slow wave sleep or deep sleep, which usually happens in the first 2 to 3 hours of the night, and if that's working properly, that our sleep is normal, we don't have sleep apnea or a noisy bed partner or a pager that's going off all night long. And there, I dated myself with pager. That's pretty good. but I always think about the pager more than the cell phone when I think of something that's just awful and disruptive sleep. That, you know, that those things are going to interfere with the natural flow of sleep. And when we do that, we compromise all the things that come from sleep. So it's always interesting to me, the 30-year-old investment banker who's making, you know, so much money, doesn't know what to do with it. He's up until midnight looking at the markets, and he's up at 5 o'clock in the morning to be in the gym. And he's really careful about his body and reads all the stuff. And hey, I heard on Huberman podcast, blah, 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 you know, great. Like, but you're getting 5 hours of sleep. Like, do you understand that all this stuff you're putting into it is, it's like going to the gym, but not consuming protein. Well, you got to have something for your body to build itself with. So testosterone is secreted normally when we sleep. And so when you shortchange sleep, either in terms of quantity or quality, you're going to take away testosterone. You're going to remove growth hormone. You're going to take all these things out of the equation that we need to be healthy. Not to mention the fact that, you know, quality sleep that's happening on a schedule sort of is the conductor for the orchestra. You know, it's all sleep is not created equally. So if somebody says, look, I always get 8 hours of sleep, it's just a different 8 hours all the time. On the weekends, I like to stay out, go out. I'm in bed by 3-4 o'clock in the morning, if that early, but I'll get my 8 hours of sleep. It, that changing of the schedule once again is disruptive. It's if I stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning tonight and go to bed and get 8 hours of sleep, it's not guaranteed that I'm getting the same amount or even any deep sleep. My body might just sidestep it because my sleep's happening at an unusual or an unpredicted time. Mm-hmm. So that's why we really start to see the rise of things like chrononutrition. Is it you are what you eat, or is it more you are when you eat? You know, or you know, when you look at things that are disrupting the circadian rhythm, I like the term, and I did not coin it, but I wish I had, a circadian arrhythmia. I think that's fantastic. Where, you know, if you want to be at your best, follow the path of the military. Every day is exactly the same. Up at this time, meals at this time, exercise at this time, plenty of light, social interaction. You know, it just that sort of scheduled existence is really the healthiest in terms of all the things we need, including testosterone.
Wow. Okay. So when you talk about like an 8 hour night of sleep, and we just talked about testosterone being released, growth hormone being released, what other things happen during sleep, during that 8 hours? And like, are there buckets in that 8 hour window that if you miss them or skip certain hours, that you just completely eliminate that from your life?
Yeah. I mean, I was just talking to a reporter earlier today about the glymphatic system, which was discovered not too long ago. It was, even back when I was in medical school, it was believed that the brain did not have a lymphatic system. It was later discovered by a woman in Maryland, Nettegard, I believe is her name. And she said, oh, it's got it. The brain has a lymphatic system. It's just different. And it's very hard to see on dissection. She named it the glymphatic system. And one of the interesting things about it is that it's far more active in terms of pumping out brain waste during sleep than when we're awake, 10 to 15 times more active, and primarily active during deep sleep. So I tend to kind of organize my clinic and talk during my sleep podcast in ways about, it's not about not drinking alcohol. It's not about not staying up late. It's about understanding what these things do and making sure they're the exception, not the rule. Like, I mean, friends are having a big Super Bowl party every year and it's so much fun and they make all these crazy fun drinks and have pizza and all this homemade barbecue. I think you should go if you want to go. And I think you should drink if you want to drink. Just understand that alcohol tends to suppress REM sleep. It tends to affect deep sleep negatively, particularly during the first half of the night. If you're staying up really late, well, we do the Super Bowl party, then we all go out to the high school and we play football until 3 o'clock in the morning and it's so much fun, then do it. But just understand your body was expecting deep sleep from 11 to 2 a.m. And now it's 3 a.m. and you're still out in some high school reliving your glory days from when you were on the football team. That's fine. But when you go finally get into bed at 4 a.m., your body is not thinking, okay, time for deep sleep. It's what it was, what's typically happening during 4 a.m., intermittent light sleep and REM sleep before you wake up. So if you always go to bed at 4 a.m., sure, eventually you kind of adjust, but some research would say not entirely, which is why when you look at daylight saving time, which we're about to enter into, people think, well, it's 1 hour adjustment, which it is. You know, it's not that big of a deal. Like people need to like relax about it. Like somebody, you know, anyway, a whole other story. But there are some people who look at research and say, look, we never entirely adjust to daylight saving time, which is why we should probably all be on standard time permanently.
Yeah.
It's difficult to get lawmakers to understand that. So when you start looking at these types of things, we can adjust to them, but the real terrible situation is I work 7A to 7P for 7 days or 14 days. I was just up in Maryland talking to the state police up there. And then after 2 weeks or after a month, they switch to 7P to 7A. So it takes about an hour for us to adjust, or a day to adjust 1 hour. So if you're going 7A to 7P to 7P to 7A, after 14 days, you've adjusted, you know, after 12 days, you've adjusted. Well, then 2 days later, 14 days later, 2 weeks later, you're switching back. So those kinds of schedules are carcinogenic and devastating to our health. And if you're like, well, how is it devastating your health? How is it not? Like, name an organ system that's not affected by these kinds of adjustments in our schedule, and I'd be shocked to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting you say that. One of the things I recently read was about the concept of people have natural sleep times. Like, either call them like night owls or early birds, or whatever they were called.
Chronotype. Yeah.
Chronotype. Absolutely. Is it, if you are, how do you, A, would you check that? You have to do like a blood test. And B, if you find, they say there's people in that actually have no preference. And can you train yourself to be one or the other if you have the certain chronotype?
Yeah. So chronotype's interesting. Chronotype's been around forever. Like every, you know, 10 years, somebody gives it a funny name. Like, you know, are you a honey badger? Are you a, you know, boll weevil? But I mean, the bottom line is it's basically, if you put everybody in a cave that had no light and no indication in terms of what time it is, and they did this, Nathaniel Kleitman and Bruce Richardson did it many, many years ago in Mammoth Cave, Kentucky. There was a Jürgen Aschoff in Germany had this like underground apartment that he would like pay grad students to live in that had no time cues in it. So you could stay in there and you could cook and go to sleep when you wanted to, wake when you wanted to, study, but you had no idea what time it was. Everybody falls onto certain schedules, you know, and when you introduce light, if you kind of think about the bell curve distribution, there's some people like to get up early and other people get up late. I've heard arguments that I believe that if we all lived outside, you took away the environmental, you know, cues, our chronotypes would be a lot closer. Like it wouldn't be quite as spread out. The people who wake up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, people who are up and ready at 3 a.m., like it would be a lot more tighter. And I think that the United States Military Academies probably prove that when you look at, you know, when these individuals arrive and when they leave, if you control those variables, everybody tends to kind of cluster around the same time. But they are genetic. They are moldable. But I think a lot of people would say your genes are your genes. So if you take somebody out of the Naval Academy and say, okay, here's $1 million, live the way you want to live, you would probably drift back to perhaps the way you were before. They're influenced by age. Younger people tend to be a little bit more what we call circadianly delayed. They want to stay up late. Older individuals, senior citizens, they're looking for tickets to Dune 2 that begin at 2 o'clock in the afternoon because they couldn't go to see a 5 o'clock show because that would put them at 8 o'clock, and that's way past their bedtime, your kind of thing. So and there's nothing right or wrong about them. You know, in terms of people not having a preference, and not having a circadian rhythm are probably two different things, meaning you're probably going to have some sort of rhythm. Although, you know, there are some people who have brain injuries or blind people who are not getting cues through, you know, light that have what are called free running or irregular, you know, rhythms that can be even considered a disorder, you know, where you're struggling to fall asleep and wake up because your brain doesn't really sense the time and understand when it's supposed to be doing things. But for the most part, we all have a, a circadian rhythm. Some people are kind of intermediate. Like there's something called a Horn-Ostberg test or a morningness, eveningness questionnaire. If you type it into your browser, it'll pop up and you can take the test and it'll tell you, okay, well, you know, based upon the way you answered these 28 questions, you're a super night owl, or you're kind of a morning person, or you're intermediate. And yeah, I think it matters. You know, I always talk about people's sleep kind of fall into three categories. How much do you need? Are you a 9 hour person? Are you a 6.5 hour person? I say 8 using that term as the average. It doesn't mean that, you know, everybody listening to this podcast needs 8 hours. In fact, 7 hours is probably research wise the healthiest amount of sleep to get when you look at, you know, negative health outcomes. 8 was kind of a long story as to why that got adopted as the number we always throw around, but 7's probably a better one. But, you know, some people require less, fewer hours, some people require more. And then there's timing of sleep. Okay, you're a 7 hour person, but you like late, you know, stay up late, get up late, or you're a morning person. And then I always kind of throw in the genetics of what I call horsepower, which is, well, what if you get no sleep? How do you function the next day? And those people can kind of be wild cards in terms of, oh, I'm good as long as I get 2 hours of sleep. Well, no, you're not, but you may have a capacity to function a little bit better the next day than a person who doesn't have that kind of horsepower gene, but it doesn't mean you're doing the right thing from the perspective of your health.
So how could you, if you want to know, you want to optimize your performance from a training perspective, is there a way to test the, like you say, the chronotype? And is there a way to test how many hours of sleep you actually need? Like if I only knew that I needed 7, like I try to get 8, but some nights I'll get 7, especially with a little guy, that makes it somewhat challenging. How can you test that? Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something you use like a blood test for. Theoretically, you could do a genetic test. You know, there's been several genes identified with short sleepers and whatnot. I don't know how fruitful that would be. In terms of how much sleep an individual needs, you know, I think that's a great place to employ sleep trackers. You know, they get kind of a bad rap and sleep experts like to put them down. Oh, they're not as good as a sleep study. Well, shit, no, they're not as good as a sleep study, but I get to wear my sleep tracker every day versus your sleep study that happened on one random Tuesday night where I was stressed out about, you know, the final episode of True Detective Night Country. Like, so that wasn't a representative night of my sleep, you know? So I think one of the strengths of fitness trackers, particularly in 2024, is they do a good job of evaluating sleep time. I think where we get into the weeds with these things sometimes is they don't do a great job evaluating sleep stages. You know, how much REM sleep did you get or deep sleep? I think that's a little bit up for grabs. Although I would say, if somebody says, look, Chris, I've been wearing a sleep tracker for the last month, I never get more than 2 minutes of deep sleep. I mean, I would pay attention to that as a physician. Like, okay, well, and you know, it's funny because my girlfriend has the same tracker. We got them for each other for our birthdays, and she always gets 2 hours of deep sleep. Like, I would, okay, well, let's look into that a little bit. How do you feel? I feel miserable. Every time I sit down, I fall asleep. Okay, well, now we're sort of putting together a case for maybe the fact that that's real. But, you know, in terms of trying to figure out how much sleep you need, I think that those devices are great in terms of, you buy your Fitbit, Withings watch, Whoop band, Aura ring, whatever you like, and just wear it for 30 days.
Do you have one you like?
I wear a Withings watch mainly because I like the little pad that goes underneath your bed. I think it does a good job of tracking sleep, but I also like it just because I think it looks like a nice watch. I like to get dressed up when I give a lecture and stuff like that. And I don't want like a black nylon band around my, I've got all of them. I think, you know, but if I'm working out and if I was really like a serious athlete, I don't want to wear this thing when I'm, you know, training my jujitsu, like for my big tournament or whatever, you know. So I like Whoop bands when it comes to like elite kind of athletics. They're kind of bulletproof. I think they give great information. I think the Aura ring's nice in terms of, I have a lot of patients, clients, athletes who don't like stuff on their wrist. And I talk to people like, yeah, just get a Whoop band, wear it at night. Well, I could never wear something on my wrist at night. Really? Okay. Well, so the Aura band kind of disappears, you know, like you kind of forget it's there. So I like them all. I mean, I think Fitbit kind of led the way there. I've disclosure, I was an expert witness in something related to Fitbit, you know, on the Fitbit side. You know, somebody complained that like I thought I was getting 2 hours of deep sleep and the Fitbit said one. And so they sued stupidly. I mean, whatever, like, you know, kind of thing. So anyway, yeah. So I mean, I think we have to kind of look at anything. I mean, you should look at what I say to you as a patient with a grain of salt. That's certainly a thing you put on your wrist. So, but I think that they do a really good job of, you know, at the end of your month, you pull out your little app and turn it on. And what does it say? And it says, wow, it seems like you're averaging 7 hours and 2 minutes of sleep per night. And then the next question is, how do you feel? Like, if you sit down during a really boring art history lecture at 2 o'clock in the afternoon during the week, what's going to happen? Oh, I'd be totally awake and engaged. Like, I feel great, Chris. Like, even if you give me opportunities to take a nap, I wouldn't fall asleep. Then 7 hours and two might be perfect for you. What if I said, okay, well, over the next 2 weeks, I really want you to get 7 hours and 30 minutes of sleep. Like, that's your goal. Go to bed at 11. I want your alarm clock for 6:30. How do you feel? You're going to either come back and say, you know, I'm getting 7.5 hours now. My Whoop band confirms that. And I actually feel better. Or yeah. You're going to come back and say, I'm struggling to fall asleep, or I'm waking up half hour before my alarm clock goes off. Those are good indications that maybe you're not built for 7.5 hours, you know? Yeah. So to me, it's kind of that thing. Pick a number, stick with it. And then as you add sleep, does that make you feel better, or is it only making it more difficult for you to fall asleep or stay asleep? At some point, you know, I like pizza. Well, here, I have a piece of pizza. Do you want more? Yes. Okay, here's another piece. Do you want more? Yes. And then eventually you're not going to finish it. Like, sleep's kind of that way too. Like, okay, well, you're a 2.5 slice guy. Like, you know, well, you're a 7 hours and 20 minute person. So then once you've got that number, that's a great way to design your schedule. Okay, my number is 7.5. When I try to get 8, I always fail. It's very rare for me to get 8 unless I'm making up for, you know, a work night where I stayed out late or something.
Is it
true? And
then
once you've set your schedule, let it go.
Is it true you can, like, if you sleep too much that you actually wake up and you feel tired? I've had that.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes. Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, again, it's timing. And when you talk to people about that situation, it's always a weekend thing. Oh, yeah, Saturday, I didn't have anything to do on Saturday, so I just slept in. And they'll tell you, I woke up at my normal time. And then I was like, screw this. And I rolled over and went back to sleep. And then instead of waking up at 7, I woke up at 9:45 or, you know, 10:10 or whatever. And you felt groggy, right? Because your brain was like, well, this is our wake up time. Like, what's going on here? And so you're going back to sleep and your brain's like, all right, well, I guess we're not eating. I guess we're not catching the subway. I guess we're not, you know, exposing ourselves to light, talking to our partner, doing all the things we normally do. So your body re-enters sleep and the cycling of sleep. And then, you know, eventually you kind of wake up. And so your body's not, we call it sleep inertia. And so your body's kind of not used to it. So it's funny. I mean, people you talk to who say, I wish I had just gotten up at my normal time. The extra sleep really didn't help me any, which is why I always tell people, if you want to do what, you know, the right thing, and nobody ever does, it's get up at the normal time on Saturday, walk your dog, eat your overnight oats, expose yourself to sunlight, check your headlines, answer some texts in your emails, you know, look at Dr. Winter's Instagram page because it's awesome. It's not awesome. It's terrible. And then if you're like, you know what? I'm pretty tired from this week. There was a couple nights where I really shortchanged myself. Go back, just take a nap. But at least that way you've maintained the order of your morning and that circadian rhythm of this is the start of the day. And then just build in a nap at some point earlier in the day. So you're kind of adding to last night versus you're subtracting from the upcoming night. I think that makes, you know, a lot of sense.
Nap instead of sleep in. I like that. There's something else I read recently. It was talking about the use of coffee and how I don't drink coffee. I just hate the taste of it. I always have. I think it's gross.
I don't care for that, John.
Yeah.
I'm not, I don't like your kind.
I know. I think I'm the only guy.
I think we really need to eliminate the political divisions we have and just hate each other based upon solely coffee use or not.
I know.
You know, that's, I think totally. We'd be a whole lot happier.
Totally. So when I was reading about it, I was fascinated, like, what does caffeine do and how does it work? And it was talking about this concept of, like, sleep pressure. So if you don't consume coffee, what it was explaining, and I hope you can go into some more detail, is you build this sleep pressure in the system. And so when you go to sleep, then you fall asleep. Well, when you use caffeine, I think there's like a it binds on the same receptor or prevents sleep mm-hmm. pressure in some capacity. And so yeah, you're not building up that sleep pressure where you fall asleep. Can you talk about that and how that could impact athletic performance if people are using anything like a caffeine or something for performance?
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that caffeine is interesting. We did a whole podcast episode on, I can't remember, it was way back when. It was a Smith. We always make the title of the podcast something related to the a song or a lyric related to the topic. And I remember that was a Smith song. I'm blanking on it. Like, I always think Over the Hills and Far Away. It's not the name of the song, but it's got, you know, there's too much caffeine in your bloodstream was the lyric, which I love the Smiths. I can't believe I can't think of that song. But anyway, so caffeine is exactly as you described it. It is a performance-enhancing drug. It is a chemical that antagonizes the adenosine receptor in your brain. So if you remember biochemistry from a long time ago, we consume food joyously, and that food gets brought into our body and eventually broken down into ATP. And ATP gets moved into the mitochondria of our cell, which is like a little furnace. And that's where we're actually converting the food energy into energy for our brain bodies. So you lift weights, you run, you do all the things you need to do because of the energy we're getting for our food. So the byproduct of that metabolism of ATP is adenosine. So as it accumulates in your body, it is creating exactly what you said, a pressure to sleep. So when you start looking at it, you would think, okay, so when you wake up, and you've slept, sleeping sort of diminishes our body's adenosine, and we start the day fresh. And as soon as you wake up, you start building up that adenosine. It would make sense that by about midday, we should be sort of crushed by that. Like not ready to sleep necessarily, but kind of, it's like giving somebody shots all day long. Like wake up and here's a shot of Jägermeister. And then, you know, 30 minutes later, another shot, like little shots, like, but, you know, a measurable amount, like by midday, you know, people might start asking you at work, Chris, are you okay? Like, why do you keep giggling? You know, you're like, you could probably get your work done, but you wouldn't be that good at it. And you'd be measurably incapacitated, maybe not falling over drunk, but getting a good buzz on. And so what's interesting is when you look at sleep, we don't feel that typically. In other words, you can get a glimpse of it around lunchtime. Because the system that kind of rescues us usually kicks in the second half of the day. So that's kind of the reason why typically around lunch, we want to take a nap because that adenosine is built up to a certain point, but certain mechanisms have not kind of rescued us. And a lot of those mechanisms have to do with the stability of wakefulness or the stability of sleep based upon a chemical called orexin or hypocretin, which also has a lot to do with appetite as well too. So we have these things that kind of stabilize wakefulness, which is why for most people, they feel about as awake at 10 a.m. as they do 5 p.m. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense based upon the fact of what you said, you're accumulating this adenosine. So as we accumulate more and more, and it accumulates faster if we're exercising or doing something physical. So go out there and split wood or rake leaves, and you're going to say, wow, I was really sleepy that night. I slept really well. Right, because you accumulate maybe more adenosine. Pro athletes, when they're in season, they're going to accumulate a lot more than when they're out of season. So they're going to sleep harder, maybe even require more sleep. And so when we consume caffeine, we don't make that chemical go away, but we do block its effect temporarily. So now it's 11 o'clock, you know, these systems that are trying to hold back that homeostatic drive to make you want to sleep are starting to decline. You're starting to get sleepy, but you got a lot of work to do. You drink your caffeine and it will temporarily prevent that from making you feel sleepy, even though it doesn't make it go away. So as the caffeine is metabolized, the adenosine is still there. In fact, there's now more of it. So now it's really time to go to sleep or drink more caffeine. And when you look at the performance benefits of caffeine, one of the interesting things that the research would tell you is we get a lot more out of it. So if you're a competitive swimmer or something like that, if you hold off on the caffeine until the practice every day, and then you have a 24-hour period or longer without it, it tends to have more of an effect than if you're constantly just consuming caffeine. And I think caffeine use is one of the questions we always ask our patients and athletes and clients is a great hint towards sleep quality. Like how much caffeine do you drink and why do you drink it? Well, I drink one latte in the morning. I just like the ritual of it. Okay. or you lean on it. Like, I can't get through a day without it, you know? So I think that I'm a big caffeine fan. I love the ritual of caffeine, but I think that we all should ask ourselves the question, well, what if somebody took it away from you for a week or two? How would you feel? I'd be a little disappointed. Like, I'd miss it, but I'd function fine. Like, it wouldn't matter. You know, if somebody's like, oh my God, I would be devastated, terrible migraines, falling asleep during important meetings. I think that's a good question. Why? Inadequate sleep, dysfunctional sleep? Are you masking something with it?
Assuming there's no sleep dysfunction, does the use of caffeine change the way that the body would naturally adapt to the buildup of the adenosine? So let's say that we have somebody who's a caffeine user and somebody who's a non-caffeine user, and then somebody stops the coffee cold turkey. Do they go through swings where they would feel more tired than the person who wasn't the caffeine user? Or does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yeah, like, yeah. Probably.
Okay.
You know, generally speaking, I mean, even if you're somebody who says, and I've got, you know, tons of these in the clinic, oh, I could drink a whole pot of coffee before I go to bed. It doesn't affect my sleep. It does. It absolutely. In fact, I would kind of fall into that category were it not for my profession and the fact that I'm married. My wife would tell me, I can drink this latte at night. It's not going to affect my sleep. She'd say, yes, it does. Like, you're much more restless. You might talk or moan more in your sleep. I might not feel it the next day. So I think the answer to your question is yes. I think anytime we're using the caffeine, we are changing things. I think one way you can sidestep that or minimize that effect is to try to cut the caffeine off a lot earlier in the day. This was a big topic. I remember when I went out to spring training last year at this time, all my ball players were asking me questions about the timing of caffeine. Should I wait 2 hours before I drink my caffeine in the morning? And it was kind of a weird topic and not really based upon real science. But I think, you know, the question really becomes, if there's no adenosine for it to work on, is it doing anything? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you immediately wake up and immediately drink caffeine, are you getting some sort of performance benefit from it versus are you going to get more bang for your buck once you've accumulated some and started to feel sleepy? I think was the gist of it, but it was kind of warped in its thinking. So I think that earlier caffeine consumption is probably going to affect sleep less than when you start getting closer to the time you go to bed. So 4 hours, even most conservatively 6 hours prior to bedtime. So 5 o'clock, if you go to bed at 11, is probably a great time to stop consuming caffeine. If you really want to have that sort of normal, you know, sort of movement into sleep and sleep after you fall asleep.
Okay. Now, next question for you is around sugar. So I would say, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I just cut sugar from my diet. So I'll eat like fruit, but I don't eat anything processed sugar. And one of the biggest things I noticed when I did it was always normally in the afternoon around 2 o'clock, I would say I could go take a nap. And that's like 100% gone. Don't have that feeling anymore. Is that related to glucose spikes, or is there something else related to that? Or is that even relevant?
No, I think it is. I mean, when you look at, I think probably the best way to illustrate that answer is thinking about Thanksgiving. People have this idea that Thanksgiving has to do, the sleepiness we feel on Thanksgiving has to do with the turkey. It's more related to the carb bomb you've just exploded in your gut. I mean, it's the mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes with the, you know, brown sugar on top, the mashed potatoes, the stuffing, the 7 different kinds of pies. Pies are huge in my family during Thanksgiving. Like, in fact, I feel like one year we did like pie Thanksgiving where it was just like 12 different kinds of pie, something terrible like that. So, you know, you drink, you eat all those carbs and then you're 20 minutes later asleep on the couch watching the Lions lose. Although the Lions win now, right? That's not current thinking. Detroit is a winner now. But back in the day, they always lost on Thanksgiving. So, you know, what's happening there is exactly related to sugar and blood sugar changes and insulin. So when you have these sort of sugar spikes in our body, it changes the way we allow certain neurotransmitters into and out of cells, particularly in the brain. So that spike, that high glycemic index foods tend to create insulin changes that facilitate sleepiness in the brain through the neurotransmitters that we think of that with, you know, serotonin, melatonin, dopamine, all these things that we think about as related to sleep. And so, yeah, I think there's, you know, when you think about foods that are going to be, you know, hey, Chris, I want to eat food at night, but I want it to support my sleep. Sure, you can eat your hummus, which got tryptophan in it, and tartary juice and things that support melatonin. But generally speaking, high glycemic index foods tend to be kind of sleep promoting, particularly if you eat a lot of them. So my guess is what you're experiencing is sort of a mini Thanksgiving, so to speak, and the mini crash that we all have after we eat all that stuff.
So is that related in any way to the adenosine that you're talking about with sleep pressure with the sugar, or is it completely different because you're saying it's based on the hormones like or serotonin, dopamine, all those completely separate system?
Yeah, I mean, probably. I mean, adenosine really is more of a homeostatic drive, meaning the longer you are awake, the more likely you want to sleep. Now, it wouldn't surprise me if a somebody who was really smart in biochemistry, if she jumped on here and said, actually, you know, when we consume a large amount of sugar and there's a, it does tend to facilitate more ATP going into the mitochondria. I mean, I have no clue. I mean, sugar and carbohydrate, we often think of as quick energy anyway. And so quick energy means you're getting, you're processing something through the mitochondria. So my guess is there's a linkage to those two things. I'm just not smart enough to tell you what it is.
Okay. Well, that's cool. What about the concept of intermittent fasting? It's something that a lot of people do. And when you think about it from a sleep perspective, a lot of people talk about don't eat late at night, or there's a whole bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. Is there an optimal time? A, do you believe in intermittent fasting? What does the sleep research show around intermittent fasting? Is it beneficial for sleep? And is there an optimal window for performance if you are thinking about doing intermittent fasting? When would that be?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Whenever I see a patient and there's clearly been some sort of weight change, I always ask, I ask all my patients, has your weight changed? Do you feel comfortable talking about that? I don't care what somebody weighs. To me, it's more of a marker of certain things. When somebody has lost a significant amount of weight, you always want to make, is this something you're wanting to do, or is this just happening and you have no idea why? Somebody says, yeah, I've been working hard to lose weight. I always ask what has worked for you? I'm going to tell you, over the last 5 years, 9 out of 10 times that question is answered, it's something related to, dramatically reducing food intake or intermittent fasting. So yeah. I'm not a nutrition expert, and I want to be very careful. I'm not overstepping boundaries here. I don't like to talk outside of my wheelhouse, but I think you're hitting on something that's important, which is we do tend to recommend not eating close to the time when we go to bed. Parasympathetic activity, fight or flight, sympathetic activity, fight or flight, parasympathetic activity, rest and digest. And those two things kind of go together in the sense that we want to make sure that as we move towards our sleep period, we're putting our body's energy and resources into resting and maybe a little bit less digesting in terms of having food that's recently been consumed. So I always tell people, don't go to bed hungry. Make sure you have foods available to you that are sleep supportive. But if somebody says, look, I can, stop eating around dinner, I can eat my dinner and then not eat anymore until lunch the next day. I think there's always been a certain degree of research around fewer calories, more defined eating period, probably being related to, better health and longevity. But again, I'm sort of outside of that. What I like about intermittent fasting is the idea that you're now aligning your eating with the clock. What I think is really devastating is I eat when I can. And when somebody is intermittently fasting, what it's doing is basically allowing your body to understand we just need to deal with digestion from noon to 7 p.m. That's when the food is going to be consumed. So, they did a study a long time ago, I remember, where they gave a certain number of people a candy bar every, whenever they wanted it, but once a day, but just whenever you wanted to eat it. And the other group got the same candy bar at the exact same time every day, 3 o'clock or whatever. And what they found was the people who were eating that same candy bar at the same time every day had very little metabolic consequence to the eating versus the people who are eating it whenever. It's almost like you were surprising your body with it. And I remember when I was young, I worked at Camp Holiday Trails in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was a camp for kids with medical problems and disabilities. And as an undergraduate student, this would have been in the early 90s, I remember when you dealt with the children who had diabetes, they would eat their food and they would come to you and say, "Hey, Counselor Chris, I ate my mashed potatoes, peanut butter jelly sandwich, and some chicken." And you're like, "Okay, that's an interesting dinner, but great." And you calculated up the, you know, you added up the carbs and the, and then you gave them insulin based upon what they had consumed. I had the opportunity to go back there as a doctor, which clearly indicates that Camp Holiday Trails was hard up for a doctor when they're asking Chris Winter, sleep doctor, to take care of kids with like real medical problems. That's like the joke in my family. It's like, well, Chris is a doctor, but not really a real doctor. Like if you're injured or something, you're in big trouble if he's the only one around to help you out. So, but I went back and was working there and everything had changed. It was the kids came to you first and said, "I'm going to eat some chicken, peanut butter jelly sandwich and my mashed potatoes." And you'd calculate it out and give them their insulin before they ate and just pray to whatever God you prayed to that they actually ate what they said and didn't come back over after you gave them the insulin and said, "Ah, Counselor Chris, I changed," or now it's "Dr. Chris, I changed my mind. I didn't eat anything." And you're like, "Ah," like you can't take that insulin back. And now their blood sugar is going to crash. And so, but I remember talking to an endocrinologist. I was like, "I don't like this new system." And they're like, "Well, it doesn't matter what you like. This is much healthier because it's allowing their body to anticipate a meal rather than react to it. And that over a long period of time is much healthier." And that kind of illustrates kind of where we think about that with food. So I think intermittent fasting is allowing our body to understand, oh, it's noon, this is when we eat, and then we can bank on these hours of not eating. I think that's there's a healthiness there from a circadian and sleep perspective outside of nutrition, I think.
I love that. What about training times then? If you're thinking about eating at the optimal time, your body's ready to eat. Is there an optimal time to train where you're getting maximum performance, but you're also optimizing your sleep? I used to work out super late at night. I loved it. I could fall asleep right after. Now I wake up very early in the morning and I work out right away. And that's like a complete change for me. But is there an optimal time to work out to get best performance in sleep?
Yeah, this probably relates back to chronotype a little bit. You know, I usually work out a little bit later just based upon my schedule. But I think that if somebody said, "Look, what is the best time for me to work? Chris, I'll do whatever you want. What's the best time for me to work out?" I would probably say morning, but you know, there's definitely exceptions. I mean, you're a 26-year-old guy who's competing to be the closer of the Cleveland Guardians baseball organization. I don't know if the off-season 5 a.m. workout is doing you any favors in terms of in a few months, you're going to arrive in Goodyear, Arizona, start playing some games, and you're going to come in at the end of these games. So this organization is going to ask you to be athletically great at 9 o'clock, 10 p.m., 11 p.m. So it's a really interesting conversation to have with a guy who's, you know, pitching and he's gotten married a couple of years ago. Now they're starting to have kids. He's like, "You know, Chris, what I like to do is I like to get up at 5 a.m., get my workout done so I can help my wife with my kids when they wake up, get them to school." And listen, that's awesome, dad, like dad of the year. I'm not sure this is the thing that's best for your baseball career though. Like you're kind of getting yourself ready to be athletically awesome at 5 a.m. every day. And when the season starts, the only thing you're going to be doing at 5 a.m. is sleeping in your boxers in some hotel room in Toronto or Seattle or L.A. You know, so I also see this a lot with even amateur athletes. You know, "Okay, I'm doing my first half Ironman down in Puerto Rico, whatever. So when I get off of work, I go to the Equinox gym here in New York City and I go work out and do all this great stuff." Okay, great. And then you talk about how does the triathlon go? Terrible. Really? Well, what happened? The gun went off at 5 a.m. Right. Like, and I've been training at 5 p.m. Like, so I think that it's okay to do it. I mean, any exercise is great. Whenever you're thinking, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're exercising, man, you're way ahead of the curve. But if you're really trying to achieve something, like I've got this, I'm 51 and I want to bench press 300 pounds. Like this is the last shot I have for like doing that in my life. It's only going downhill from here, like growth hormone secretion downhill. Like, it's interesting when sometimes I'll go work out early in the morning, cause that's the only time I have to do it. I'm not good at that time because I generally train after my clinic. So, I mean, these things matter. So if you're like, look, I don't care, I'm just going to do a Zumba class and move on with my life. Great. Do that. But if you're like, I'm really trying to reach elite pickleball level status or something like that, and the pickleball tournaments are always at 5 p.m., I think you should at least do some training around 5 p.m. to get your body used to that performance time. At Jürgen Aschoff, that guy I was talking about, German guy who built the bunker underground, he had this great quotation that said, for everything our bodies do, there's a maximum and a minimum timing. So whether it's testosterone, body temperature. On my Instagram page, I got a thermometer during COVID. And for 24 hours, I checked my temperature every 15 minutes and it made a perfect little sine wave. Like it's fast. These things are so predictable. But athletic performance is like that too. Like go run a 5K and an hour later, run it again. An hour later, run it again. Like if you could theoretically do that and take away fatigue from the situation, you'd see at some point during the day, you'd be awesome. For most young athletes, it's 4 p.m. is the maximum timing of athletic performance. And at some point, you know, in the middle of the night, you'd be terrible. You know, 2 hours before you wake up, you're at your worst. So these things are predictable. So if you're going down to the Ironman in Puerto Rico and the gun's going off at 5 a.m., brother, you better get in the water at 5 a.m. in your pool, near your neighborhood pool at 5 a.m. at least a few times, because you're going to have a rude awakening when that blast happens.
Well, I don't make money from an athletic perspective.
But nor do I.
I recently started waking up at 4 a.m. so I could work out, get work done before my wife and my little guy wake up. And I'm telling you, man, it is like the best thing for me. I get the little guy, I take him for 2 or 3 hours in the morning when my wife goes and works out, and I can just focus on him. It's like the best. And since I think
that's great.
It's awesome. You know,
it's just, exercise is just a great way to start your day.
Yeah.
And also like the idea, when you have a crap day, you know, it's like 5 o'clock and it did not go well during the day. I mean, there are many a night where you go to bed and you're like, well, at least I got a workout in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I like that idea of just knocking it out, because if you're one of those people who are like, well, I don't have time. I'll do it after work. I mean, how many times after your work's over and you're like, oh, no way. You know, the grocery store line was crazy. I had to go get, you know, mushrooms for the stuff we're doing and some, you know, baby wipes or whatever. And by the time you get home, you're like, tomorrow, forget it today. Like, so when you knock it out early, I just kind of like that. Just it's a great thing to do it. It really kind of energizes you through the first part of your day for sure.
Well, the other thing for me too, man, when we first had a kid, I mean, he's a decent sleeper. He's not the best, but he would wake up multiple times. So what I was noticing is like, if he slept like through the night, even if I only got 6 hours of sleep, I'd rather 6 hours unbroken than like 8 hours where you're like broken. That was like destroying me. That was the hardest part.
Yeah.
And I think that's
residency, man. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It was that sort of thing where it kept getting broken up. But now too, so when I go to work out later in the day, normally I was fine. I used to like working out late at night, but by the time the night came, I was just like, oh man, I didn't have anything in me. I was in the job, I was going through the motions, but there was nothing was coming out that was supposed to do anything beneficial. So that makes some sense.
Yeah, we often overestimate how we're going to feel at 6 p.m. for sure. But I think you brought up a really interesting point too. The idea of there's lots of ways to get 7 hours of sleep. You can go to bed at midnight, wake up at 7. You can go to bed at 10, wake up at midnight, be up for a couple hours, go back to bed, take a nap. Like, so you've accumulated 7 hours over a 24-hour period, but you can feel like a bus hit you when it's all broken up like that. And so that gets into the idea of polyphasic sleeping. So we tend to do best when we keep it into one phase or maybe two.
I just got to ask this, like, this is like more of an evolutionary question. It just kind of fascinates me. You think when kids are born, right? Like the first couple years of a kid, I mean, parents can have like wild broken sleep, and like everything you have reading about sleep lately is how you have to have like, if you're not getting 8 hours or 7 hours or whatever that is, like, it's just so detrimental to your health. Have we evolved to be able to raise children in a way where we're not like impacting ourselves because of the loss of sleep?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, this gets into the idea of sleep debt, which is always a fun, you know, I find to some degree academic sleep meetings to be tiresome. I didn't think that when I was young. It was all everything's fresh and interesting. And now it's all kind of the same thing. Like, you know, people, how do you get people to wear a CPAP and this and that? But I never tire of a good sleep debt debate where you're kind of sitting in the audience and two professors are just going at it. Like, meaning, you know, so yeah, you're a parent and your kid's got colic and you're up and down all through the night. Are you killing yourself? I believe that there is a concept of a sleep debt, but we have capacity to deal with it. I mean, it's sort of like food debt. Like, I mean, have you ever skipped lunch? And when you did you call your doctor and say, I think I've really screwed things up here for my health. I didn't eat a sandwich today at lunch. No, you just, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, now going a long period of time, a big food debt could be deadly, and same with sleep. But I think that we generally do okay. So I think that, you know, there's a reason why young people have kids. And, you know, I think that we do have the capacity to absorb that. And there was a great Swiss study that basically said, look, if you look at people who get 7 hours of sleep every night, let's call them the young people who don't want to bring kids into the world. Like, they just want to spend their money on trips and fun things like that. And, you know, it could be coffee, no coffee. I don't want to have kids groups. We can divide people into, so we'll make that one group. And they're going to get 7 hours sleep every night because they really love their lives and they can't wait to get up and do fun things and plan their next trip. And then the other group of people are having kids. And when you look at the people who get 7 hours sleep every night against the key people who average 7 hours per 24, there was no difference in their morbidity or mortality. Like, as long as you average seven. So the way I look at that is, stop thinking about it as 7 hours a night and more like 49 a week. So as long as you're as long as you're a parent, you got your kid who's crying around or whatever, you know, your wife takes them over to her mother's house on the weekend and you sit there and watch some TV and you fall asleep on the couch for an hour. Okay, well, you just made back an hour that you lost Thursday night when your kid was really having a tough time. So as long as you're ending the week with the 49 hours, it doesn't really probably matter how you got it. You're going to be just fine. I think that, you know, the sleep that I lost in medical school, I'll never get back. And there was probably a health consequence to that to some extent. But, you know, we're dealing with health consequences all the time. Walk around New York City, breathe in the exhaust fumes. Okay, you just lost 7.3 seconds from your life. You know what I mean? Oh, but you had a salad for lunch. So you gained back 12 seconds. You know, like, so I think of it that way. Like, I would love to have, like, we should all have like a little meat. It was a movie where people had like a little battery on their arm. Yeah. And if they touched, like, Justin Timberlake was in it or something. Like,
you're stealing everyone's time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think everybody should have like a little, you know, red zone, green zone. So when you eat the salad, oh, look, you just gained a little bit. And then you had a Negroni. Really, oh, that wasn't a good idea. Yeah. Well, there you had a little, you know, I like that idea.
Oh, that's funny. If somebody does go into like less than that 49 per week, would you recommend they lighten training to be more like careful around training, or would you keep their training the same?
I would lighten the training if somebody said, if I lighten the training, I'd have more time to sleep. I would say that. If you're saying, no, yeah, it has nothing to do with that. I think that if you don't lighten your training, you are probably, that needle is now moving a little bit more towards likelihood of injury, likelihood of, you know, less bang for your buck. So if you're a 20-year-old and you're, you know, investment banker somewhere and you're sometimes feeling like you're coming up short with sleep, but you don't feel like it's because of the training, it's the other things in your life, it's probably okay. But I do think that when you start looking at inadequate sleep, and this has been shown in professional athletics and in both published research, but also internally, they'll tell you the less sleep an athlete gets, the fewer the hours, the more likely they are going to struggle to recover from injury, and the more likely they will get injured or sick in the first place. It's like the whole COVID vaccine. We're like, look, the COVID vaccine works better if you're well slept. So if you're like really sleep deprived, you have to mount an immune response in some way to the vaccine. And so if you're not sleeping well, you know, you're putting yourself in danger of getting sick, but you're also making these measures we take to prevent illness less effective.
Cool. So I have been on your Instagram. I do think it's pretty good, actually. Maybe it's because I don't know. I like it. But anyway, one of the things I recently saw on your Instagram was something about saunas. It looks like you've been using saunas. I know that there's been a lot of stuff coming out recently about cardiovascular health and the improvements that it has for cardiovascular health. If you know anything about that, talk about it. I'd love to hear it. But how are you using it from a sleep perspective and why?
Yeah. So the first part of your question, the cardiovascular benefit, is really interesting. I try to come at things with a very open mind, you know, in terms of, oh, this is just all, you know, fatty and, you know, F-A-D-D-Y fatty. I don't know if that's a word, you know, but when I started looking into the research, and so we did an episode of the podcast on extreme temperatures, because I thought cold plunges and saunas kind of worked well together. And Sauna Box was nice enough to send me a sauna, and Lumi sent me a cold plunge. And it was really interesting. So from a sleep perspective, if you think about temperature and sleep, which is really related to sleep, we just spend our lives in climate controlled environments, so we don't get the benefits of it. But if you're somebody listening to this podcast and you live in a tent, consider yourself lucky, because you're really getting the benefit of temperature, because as the sun goes down, you're feeling the temperature go down. And we probably respond to that as vigorously, if not more, than light. And so, and then, you know, this, as the sun rises in the morning, our temperature goes up, our sensing of that temperature really affects sleep, which is just a little quick side note. I've got a little device called a Doc Pro on my bed that you can set to start warming yourself up about an hour before your alarm clock goes off. And it's really interesting to feel that. I almost respond more to that than a sound alarm. And it's really great. Like, okay, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, catch a flight out of Tampa or something like that. Okay, well, I'm going to set this thing to start waking me, start warming at 4. So when the alarm clock goes off at 5, I've artificially started the increase of my body temperature, which would not have happened, which is why sometimes when you wake up early in the morning, you feel cold, right? Because your body temperature hasn't sort of... So when you think about it, think of it as a sine wave, up and down, up and down. We peak our body temperature 4 o'clock in the afternoon. In general, we trough about an hour or two before we wake up. If you're a night owl, that decline will happen later in the night. If you're a morning person, it happens earlier. So if you're married to a morning person, it's the reason why, you know, she's freezing cold and you're like in your underwear watching, you know, True Detective, like, whew, man, it's hot, isn't it? They're like, oh my God, so cold. Right. Because you're a morning person, school teacher. I'm married to a teacher, an educator. She works in museums and, you know, she's kind of more of a morning person. So her body temperature is going to drop earlier. So she'll be colder early. The flip side is when we wake up on the morning, you know, on Saturday, go to the farmer's market, she's ready to roll. I'm freezing and tired, because my body temperature hasn't quite come up yet. So we can maximize that. So if you think about peak and trough, we can make the peak peakier and the troughier if we increase our body temperature about an hour or two before we go to bed. So if you've got a sauna or something like that, that's a great time to use it. You know, 2 hours before you go to bed, get in there, get really heated up. And then now you hop out and you take your shower and cool off and eat something, watch some TV, your body temperature's gone even higher. And now the drop is steeper. So if you're a skateboarder and you like your ramp, man, it'd be really cool if we could make it even higher. Okay, well, now you've made it steeper by adding on to the top. The other thing you could do is say, well, let's dig out the bottom and make it even lower. And that's where kind of cold therapy kind of comes. And so for people who like to wake up, I mean, it's kind of, you know, people who enjoy hurting themselves, but like waking up and taking a cold shower, or I love, like, I'm on the little Lumi, you know, Instagram thing. These people getting up, it's still dark outside, and getting into their like 38 degree cold plunge with ice everywhere. I mean, that's hardcore, but it kind of drops that body temperature even further. So when they get out, warm up and go to their job, then they have a steeper incline. So you've kind of created the sine wave and made it even steeper. Like now you live on the moon or the desert where it's, you know, below zero at night and super hot during the day. I bet people who, you know, there's like, there's BLM people who, like, remember a Nomadland? There's people who go out there in their little van and they've got this whole little setup. I bet they sleep great because it's super hot during the day. Yep. And they're kind of outside. You've got the little tent set up on the side of their Fiat or whatever. And then they're sleeping inside the thing and it's all insulated, but it's really cold in the desert at night. So I bet they sleep really well. And that's where you can use those kinds of extreme temperatures to maybe facilitate your sleep. I think it's fantastic. Now, you mentioned cardiovascular. I'll say really quickly, some people think that when you get into the sauna and the heat is sympathomimetic, your heartbeat goes up, your blood pressure probably rises, that some people think that the sauna kind of acts like an exercise mimetic. So you can either run on the treadmill and get all hot and sweaty, heartbeat going up, or you can sit on your butt in the sauna and it kind of does the same thing. And as part of that may have sort of cardiovascular benefit as well too. I also read a lot of theories that talk about exposing yourself to something that's not inherently healthy. Like if you stay in that sauna too long, you're going to die. You know what I mean? Like I was at the Equinox Club not too long ago and they put me in an infrared sauna to try it out. And the little attendant kept walking by looking in the window like, oh God, is Dr. Winter still alive in there? And you better hydrate. Like they were worried, like, you know, like, I don't know if a guy can take it. He's kind of old guy, you know, looking in there. So I think that it's important. So, but the theory was if you expose yourself to something that's dangerous a little bit over and over again, there might be a benefit to that too. And I had a cool term for it that I do not remember. But anyway, it's in the podcast. So that some people think that the cardiovascular benefit of that is that thing. Expose yourself to a little bit of negative over and over again. It kind of becomes a positive.
Yeah, no, because right back to what I was saying in the beginning, scarcity and abundance. It's the guy that I listened to recently talking about is Dr. David Sinclair out of Harvard. I don't know if you know who that is or not. He's a longevity
guy.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He talks a lot about that. The cold stuff is basically you're putting yourself in a stress state, right? These minor stress states, and that actually creates a positive.
Which correct. I think is very fascinating. Exactly. Yeah, I think so too.
Thank you so much. You're always a great guy to have on, Funny. Great stuff. I am going to point people to your Instagram because you do have an awesome Instagram. So go check out his Instagram. Anything else we can do for you to send people your way? What's the best way to get in touch if people want to learn more?
Yeah, Instagram, Dr. Chris Winter. It's also my TikTok and Twitter. I'm on all those things, or I guess X now. And then my podcast is Sleep Unplugged with Dr. Chris Winter. We just record it. We come out weekly. We just recorded our 88th episode, I think, on weighted blankets, which was kind of fun. So yeah, check us out on there. And if you have ideas for topics in the future that you're interested in, just hit me up on social media.
Cool. Excellent, man. Thank you so much for being on, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Leave a review or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.